Derrick's Little Sister, an additional discussion in two parts. Part 1, 34 minutes. Here we're going back and taking a look at Derrick's little sister and exploring more about the ways in which she is a Christ-like figure. And to do this, we're taking a look at more that has been written about Christ and his symbolic meaning. In this part of the discussion, I inadvertently use the name Derrick, when really I mean to be saying Derrick's little sister. So each time you hear me say Derrick, you have to substitute Derrick's little sister.
To the extent that Derrick...
That should be Derrick's little sister.
...is like Christ as a symbolic figure. It doesn't so much represent the progressive phases of development where you sacrifice the old and you go on to the next stage. It's something more dramatic and mysterious than that. And I thought it would be good to talk about more about what the image of Christ can be understood symbolically, psychologically. And then we can better understand what some of the depth of what the Derrick image means. So what I'm gonna read a couple of things from Ego and Archetype by Edinger. This was written in the 60s. He used to be here in New York. And it's a very profound book. His point of view is a Christian minister or something at one point, so you know you have to make allowances for that. But I think what he says is really profound. So I'm going to read you a few things. He argues that Christ is an image of the individuating ego. That's the symbolic, that's the psychological meaning of the mythology that is so prevalent in our culture. But here he's talking about Christ. Although details of Christ's life remain uncertain, a definite historical personality with astonishing psychological insight is revealed in the Gospels. Jesus was probably an illegitimate child. When the personal father is missing, there is no layer of personal experience to mediate between the ego and the numinous image of the archetypal father. In a personal father, you just have to deal with the archetype. A kind of hole is left in the psyche, through which comes the powerful archetypal contents of the collective unconscious. Such a condition is a serious danger. It threatens inundation of the ego by the dynamic forces of the unconscious, causing disorientation and a loss of relation to reality. If, however, the ego can survive this danger, the hole in the psyche becomes a window providing insights into the depth of being. So he's saying this is true for everybody, every illegitimate child, and that Christ was an example of that. Jesus would appear to fit the above description. He experienced a direct relation to the heavenly, that is, archetypal father, and described in numerous vivid symbolic images the nature of the kingdom of heaven, that is, the archetypal psyche. It is evident from his teachings that he had a profound awareness of the reality of the psyche. The reality of the psyche is Jung's phrase to refer to the fact that psychological reality is intensely real and important to us, even though it's not concretely real. Whereas Mosaic law recognized only the reality of deeds, Jesus recognized the reality of inner psychic states. For example, he said, "You have heard that it is said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that anyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment." And again, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery." I guess this is the Ten Commandments, right? Sorry. "But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." These passages have a major psychological import. They represent transition from a kind of behavioristic psychology to one that is aware of the reality of the psyche as such without concrete actions. Now, I'm not sure whether he's giving Judaism a fair shake here, because as I say, he's got a Christian bias, but that's not exactly the point I'm trying to get at. The gospel accounts abound in many other major psychological discoveries. Jesus formulated the conception of psychological projection 2,000 years before depth psychology. He said, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye with never a thought for the great plank in your own eye?" Projection. He recognized the danger of psychic identification with parents and family. Today, analysts still encounter references to the commandment to honor one's mother and father as justification for a state of unconscious identity with the parents. Jesus expressed himself clearly on this issue. "I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes will be those of his own household." And what Edinger understands by this is, a man's foes are those of his own household, because it is those to whom he is closest and with whom he is most apt to be identified unconsciously. Such identifications must be dissolved, because an awareness of radical separateness is a prerequisite for individuation. Jesus singles out the Father for special mention, "And call no man your father on earth, for you have one Father who is in heaven." And what, in Edinger, translate this to mean, "Parents have power over their grown children only because the latter continue to project the images of the archetypal parents onto their personal parents. To call no man father means to withdraw projections of the father archetype and discover it within. Jesus demands a commitment to the self which transcends loyalty to any personal relationship. He who loves father or mother not more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me." And then he talks about Jesus' ethical teaching. Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Understood psychologically, the meaning would be, the ego which is aware of its own emptiness of spirit or meaning is in a fortunate position, because it is now open to the unconscious and has the possibility of experiencing the archetypal psyche. "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Mourning is caused by the loss of an object or person who is carrying an important projected value. In order to withdraw projections and assimilate the content into one's own personality, it is necessary to experience the loss of projection as a prelude to rediscovering the content or value within. Therefore, mourners are fortunate because they're involved in a growth process. They will be comforted when the lost projected value has been recovered within the psyche. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Subjectively understood, meekness will refer to an attitude of the ego towards the unconscious. Such an attitude is fortunate because it is teachable and open to new considerations, which can lead to a rich inheritance. To inherit the earth suggests an awareness of being individually related to, or having a personal stake in the wholeness of life. "Blessed are they that are persecuted," and this is particularly relevant to Derrick, "blessed are they that are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for justice's sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And what this means psychologically, ego shall needs to endure pain and hurt without succumbing to bitterness and resentment, in order to be related to the objective inner law. Such an ego attitude is rewarded by being in contact with the archetypal psyche and its healing, life-giving images. Major point of these sayings, as understood psychologically, is to praise the emptied or non-inflated ego. And I'll say more about that. Well, let me just illustrate what that means right now. If we think about real estate, you can think about an inflated ego as being an ego which has a relationship of possession to real estate. Like Donald Trump is a good example of an inflated ego, I think. And so he's somebody who is, while he owns the building, is totally identified with his importance and value as the owner of the building. He's, I have a lot of money, I own a lot of real estate, I'm important, I'm strong, I'm powerful, I'm interesting. You know, this is my strength, in that I possess all of this stuff. So that's the inflated position. And it's the position of ego strength in the early part of maturity, when maturity takes the form of wanting to be stronger and more powerful and more dominant in business or in the culture. It's the warrior mentality, if you like. So in that stage, one, the ego is identified with the powers which are potential in the self. And the ego feels that the ego is the self, and that's why the ego is strong. And this is a stage which helps one to develop confidence and strength in the world, but there's a kind of a psychological blindness associated with that. And so the later stage, a more stage in the process of individuation, is, might perhaps be when one feels like the janitor of the building rather than the owner of the building. In other words, the building represents the archetypal riches, and the janitor is somebody who tries to take care of them and maintain them, look after the heating and the sweeps the floors, but doesn't identify with the building as personal property. So it's a much more humble, meek, if you like, attitude towards the psyche. Donald Trump would not identify with being the janitor. It's like in Buddhist tradition, there's a stage in life where a man who wishes to do this gives away all his possessions and becomes a beggar and goes wandering around with a begging bowl, teaching perhaps, or at least begging. It's a stage of wisdom after the ego has achieved riches or success in the material world. It's a similar idea. Now, Edinger goes on to say that the crucifixion is a confusing but important image of this. The drama of the crucifixion and the events leading up to it are expressions of the ultimate aspects of individuation. Individual experiences of scorn, disgrace, and rejection take on meaning when related to the archetypal paradigm. Christ's attitude in the Garden of Gethsemane: "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." This is a classic statement of the ego attitude needed in the face of an individuation crisis. With such an attitude, support from the archetypal psyche is usually forthcoming. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Is a characteristic feature of crucial phases of individuation. The ego feels utterly deprived of comfort and support, both from within and from without. Trust is abruptly terminated. This state is a transition period. It is the limbo of despair following the death of an old life orientation and preceding the birth of a new one. Jesus' resurrection symbolizes the birth of a more comprehensive personality, which can result from the conscious acceptance of the crucifixion ordeal. The central image of the Christian myth is the crucifixion itself. For close to 2,000 years, the image of a human being nailed to a cross has been a symbol of Western civilization. Irrespective of religious belief or disbelief, this image is a phenomenological fact of our civilization. Hence, it must have something important to tell us about the psychic condition of Western people. The crucifixion was the culmination of Jesus' earthly life. In the course of being crucified, Jesus' ego and Christ, Jesus as ego and Christ as self, merge. The human being, ego, and the cross mandala become one. Almost finished. Christ is both man and God. As man, he goes to the cross with anguish, but willingly. As God, he willingly sacrifices himself for the benefit of mankind. Psychologically, this means that the ego and the self are simultaneously crucified. The self suffers nailing and suspension, a kind of dismemberment, in order to achieve temporal realization, Now, what that is saying is that in order for the potential psyche, self being the archetypal potential of the psyche, in order for it to have some reality in the world, it has to be dismembered and pinned down into the earth. Because if it's just floating above as potential, it's lovely potential, limitless potential, but it's not actually in existence. So in order for the archetypal psyche to have some reality, it has to be dismembered and attached to limited human reality. And that's the idea of God crucified on earth. So it's a dismemberment of God. And you know, and you think of it in terms of narcissistic issues. Narcissistic grandiosity holds on to a limitlessness. It doesn't want to be limited, so it's like a poor psychology. The young man doesn't want to get married, doesn't want to choose a career, doesn't want to give up all options, wants to hold all options open. So he's holding on to a limitless phase. At this phase, young men are not much good for relationships with women because they don't want to commit themselves to anything. So it's a phase of development. But when a young man sacrifices that limitless potential and commits himself to a career, a job, buying a house, getting married, having children, then he has to accept limitation in all those areas. And that's like the crucifixion. Which is why, you know, it's a bit of a feeling about that.
It's interesting, the idea of the necessity of discipline towards, let's say, an evolution of spirit. It just seems like the Western Christ image is, I shouldn't say unnecessarily violent, but let's say far more bloodletting than, let's say, an Eastern Buddhist path of, you know, regular meditations, discipline, for sure. But the bloodletting it doesn't seem quite as violent.
Yes.
I'm just wondering what it's about the Western psyche that seems to require that blood sacrifice, where Eastern wouldn't—I don't think they'd cut to that quite as much.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Eastern psychology or mythology.
It's just kind of the same thing as what you're saying, just more of a gentle, you know, discipline in Eastern traditions, as I understand it, is extraordinarily important. But it's more of a gradual. It's more of a gradual path as compared to, really like a sacrifice to the bull. You know, taking the axe and really swiping it.
I would wonder. Again, I don't know much about Eastern psychology or religion, but I would wonder whether maybe there's less of the positivistic, ambitious ego in Eastern psychology. You know, it's a more communal culture, more. It's less of the individual self.
The entire Bhagavad Gita is, you know, about war, the war of the self, and it's a kind of internal violence.
Jihad, internal jihad.
I just want to read a little bit more here, and then I'll stop. The self's willingness to leave its eternal unmanifest condition and share the human condition indicates that the archetypal psyche has a spontaneous tendency to nourish and support the ego. We talked about that with Dirac Rafters, the lizards crying out, trying to protect Dirac. You know, that the very archetypes of the unconscious promote this individuation journey that she's going on. Here the passage implies, though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. For the ego, on the other hand, crucifixion is a paralyzing suspension between opposites. It is accepted reluctantly out of the inner necessity of individuation, which requires a full awareness of the paradoxical nature of the psyche. I wanted to read you that because it fills us in a little bit about how the Christ myth is understood as representing individuation. And then if we think about Dirawick, there's some things about her that correspond. For example, the suffering she goes through. You know, she stays awake night after night. She doesn't eat. She's starving. She's going without sleep.
Well, that's her little sister, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I mean the little, I'm trying to talk about the little sister. I've been saying to her, but I'm referring to her sister in much. But the suffering she goes through. The fact that she is kind of like the whistleblower. She's the one, you know, everybody else is sleeping at night and going along and things are hunky-dory, but she's saying, no, wait a minute, something's not okay here. This dog is not a real dog. We shouldn't trust this dog. So she's a kind of a whistleblower. And in the beginning, when she interprets the meaning of the ox's tail, she says, wait a minute, that means that the ox has been sacrificed because your brother wants to marry you. You know, she names the bad shit, and Christ was a kind of a whistleblower. That was, and whistleblowers get persecuted. You know, for it's not a good thing to, it's not a wise thing to do. If you blow the whistle, the first thing that happens is that the collective attacks you.
There's a phrase from the West that describes that. The pioneers get the arrows, the settlers get the lamp.
yeah, okay. And remember that the little sister first appears when sexual abuse is being proposed. And it's the little sister who speaks out against this. The relatives were going to go along with it. They said, well, I don't know, you know, the father, the relatives didn't have anything to say about this. They didn't know. If the brother wants to marry his sister, so be it. You know, if you want to do it, I don't have an opinion on this. But Derek's little sister had an opinion. She spoke out against incest and said, this is terrible, shouldn't happen. Castrate. Kill him, you know, with a knife. So in so doing, Dirawick does this at the behest of her little sister. And then, since now Dirawick and her little sister have protested against this patriarchal or male abuse, they then are exiled from the community. They have to flee the community for 5 years because they've murdered the brother. And so it is with, you know, when if somebody's the victim of incest, there's a tendency within the family to ignore it, to pretend it didn't happen, because they don't want to name the father or the brother who was the abuser, because he's, you know, an important part of the family. So oftentimes the victim of abuse is the one who gets punished for speaking out. The history of Freudian psychology is very relevant here, because Freud in a 19th century patriarchal Viennese Austrian culture discovered that there were a lot of young women who were hysterical and psychologically disturbed and came to see him, and they were saying again and again that they had been abused, sexually abused in their families by their fathers or their older brothers. And so Freud's initial statement of his psychological theory was that hysteria had to do with the suppressed pain and outrage suffering and anger of these abused women, which they themselves were unconscious of, because the women had been abused and then they had forgotten it and suppressed their feelings about it, because they lived in this patriarchal environment where it was forbidden to remember this. They blamed themselves, they forgot it. They had hysterical symptoms, but they didn't know what the sound symptoms were about. And what Freud said was that he was discovering through the talking process, through listening to these women talk about it, he was discovering that they had been sexually abused and that they had forgotten the memories of their abuse. But this was in a 19th century patriarchal culture, and the citizens of Austria were outraged by this, and they wouldn't have it. You know, Freud realized that his psychological theories would be suppressed if he continued to insist that this was what was going on, because the culture would suppress this knowledge. He was a whistleblower, and he was not going to get away with it. So he changed his theory. And he said, "It's maybe it's not so much real incest, but it's the fantasy of incest, which women are suppressing." So, in other words, he wound up blaming the women a little bit. You know, the problem is these women are having these sexual fantasies, and then they suppress them. So there's an example. It's a horrendous example. It's a horrible story. Because Freudian psychology is in part founded on this theory of sexual fantasy and on Freud's own willingness to sacrifice his own truth, which he had discovered, that there was a lot of sexual abuse. And now, you know, now we're more sophisticated about this. We know there's a lot of sexual abuse. And we're not surprised that in a repressed patriarchal culture like existed then, that there was a lot of abuse which was not being acknowledged. But then, you know, we have the recent history of the Catholic Church to confirm all this. You know, the people who children or kids who complained about having been abused by Catholic priests were suppressed rather than supported by the Church. You know, it's an example of how incest or sexual abuse has been suppressed, the consciousness of it has been suppressed. And here is this African story which is really addressing the same issue. You know, because what Derek's little sister and Derek are doing is highly unconventional in African patriarchal culture too. You
know? It's kind of interesting where Derek is seems like the feminine, to a large extent, the feminine individuation process. I'm wondering, is a suppression of, like, let's call it discrimination, the little sister, in that suppression, is that also parallel in the male psyche? It wouldn't seem to be as applicable. Because let's say the male psyche is going through this individuation process, and there's this inner voice of discrimination that can see the truth. It doesn't necessarily mean that voice for the masculine has to be sacrificed in the same manner.
No, I think it's highly applicable for both sexes. That's why I talked about whistleblowers.
I mean, not in the culture of the church, but I'm just talking about within the internal male psyche.
Yeah, the sex doesn't make any difference, I think. The individuation process is exhausting and I want to say bloody, metaphorically. It's a bloody process because it's not an easy ride. I mean, giving up, like I say, if you think about Donald Trump, for Donald Trump to go through the individuation process, he would have to identify with the janitor rather than the real estate. That's a kind of an emptying out of ego strengths, and that's not the collective. The collective doesn't have anything to say about this. The collective, our collective, and most other collectives say the object of life is to be successful, right? Write books, be published, be famous. You know, speak at conferences, become an authority, become rich, become a successful politician, become president of the United States, become a congressman. make money, buy a house in the country, right? Own a Mercedes Benz. But this is antithetical to individuation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I work with some of the Sephardic Jewish communities. I have a close relationship with a Lebanese Jew who owns a bunch of stores. And I asked him who is more happy, the average man walking through Manhattan or the actual guy in Beirut walking the streets. And, you know, serious discussion. He tells me that it's really the guy in Beirut, because this whole need for possession and this American ideal isn't nearly as prevalent in some of these Middle Eastern countries.
Right.
Can I share a slide? I want to talk about Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert by any way, shape, or means. I mean, nothing. But this story about Dirawak doesn't surprise me now that the Africans who were spinning out this story around fires or whatnot for who knows how many millennia, it doesn't surprise me that this story comes out of Africa. This story about female personhood. And I have to preface, I have to say a little bit of a story. Our culture has been basically enslaved by our history. This culture arises with these parallel issues of human freedom right next door to slavery. So a Nigerian I worked with told me the following story. At least in West Africa, while there would be wars between tribes, the winner of the war wouldn't kill off the vanquished. They would simply incorporate the new people into their culture. They would, sort of like an extensive Marshall Plan, they would just incorporate them in and give them land and teach them the new language, but there wasn't anything of this brutality that we've seen in the West. There was this value of human life. So the way slavery came about in this country was that the slavers came into Africa and they convinced the kings, the so-called Obas, like Obama comes from king, they convinced the Obas that, you know, we'll give you some money and you give us some of your population and we'll take them to the New World and they'll have a good life in the New World. So the Obas were more than willing to give up people to the slavers because they thought, you know, nothing bad was going to happen to their population and everybody was going to benefit. And this is sort of how slavery came about. But to me, this is sort of a glimpse into an image of Africa that our culture doesn't know a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
That there was this respect for the sanctity of life. So when I heard the story of Dirawak, it sort of just was very consistent with me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's perhaps accurate to say that Western culture has focused a lot on developing the individual ego strength, starting with the knights riding around on horses, slaughtering everybody with the, you know, the being, you know, powerful individuals. Mm-hmm.
This is the end of part one. The discussion continues in part two. Thank you.